According to the Minister of Trade, the Sana'a government has put together an economic plan to boost the battered Yemeni economy and compensate for the products which have been banned. They believe this will help Yemen move towards self-sufficiency.
The ban on Swedish products only took place after much research and study on pragmatic solutions needed to replace the banned products. There are going to be many positive steps and decisions the government will take in order to increase and promote local production to stimulate the economy.
That has been involved in what they described as a war on Islam.
The banning of products from Sweden, Israel, the United States and the UK is an obligation on all Muslims worldwide. This is because of the hate and aggression these nations have toward Muslims and Islam. These are people who do not respect the religion of Allah. The banning of products from these nations is a positive step forward to teach them a lesson so that we can depend on ourselves and increase local production and industry.
The Ansarullah-backed Yemeni government said it is funding plans and initiatives to revive Yemeni production. This is necessary in order to provide food security for millions of Yemenis who have suffered tremendously from food shortages caused by the 8 year of Saudi-imposed blockade on Yemen.
The fact is, although boycotting goods from nations that support insulting Islam has some impact, it is simply not enough. This is why the Sana'a government is calling for a united Islamic front to cut off all ties with Sweden and any nation involved in sacrilegious acts against Islam. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
In an unexpected move, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said European countries need to pave the way for Ankara's bid to join the EU in return for the Turkish parliament approving Sweden's accession to NATO. Erdogan made the comments at the airport before heading towards Lithuania to attend the bloc's summit. Ankara has been holding off its approval for Sweden's NATO membership along with Hungary, while all other members have already approved its accession. Hungary has signaled that it will follow Erdogan's lead should he give the green light for Sweden to join the military alliance.
I'm calling here for these countries that are making Turkey wait for the door of European Union for more than 50 years. First, come and open the way for Turkey at the European Union, and then we will open the way for Sweden, just as we did for Finland.
Turkey signed a customs union agreement with the European Union in 1995 and was officially recognized as a candidate on December 1999. However, its membership bid was stalled due to what the EU said were Ankara's democratic backsliding and its dispute with the bloc member Cyprus.
I think Turkey's accession to EU is unlikely to happen now, for the EU's mentality is the same. They need to change the way they see Turkey. EU will not accept a country with Islamic background to become an acting member in the bloc. The EU still sees Turkey as it was before, not as it has become now, a key player in all regional issues.
U.S. President Joe Biden is set to meet with his Turkish counterpart on the sidelines of the summit. Sources close to the White House say Biden is to persuade Erdogan by approving an F-16 deal between Washington and Ankara, should the latter give the green light to Sweden's membership. The coming 2 days will witness intense negotiations between Turkey and NATO member states, with many wondering if it would end with Turkey's accession to the EU. Probably not, but Ankara will definitely harvest gains. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Just after the Friday prayers at the National Mosque in Abuja, the demonstrators raised placards condemning the desecration of the Quran in Sweden. The protesters later marched on the streets, raising the Quran in solidarity with Muslims around the world. They later stopped for a rally and called on all Muslims and people with moral sense to condemn the deliberate act. The demonstrators have condemned in strong terms the sacrilege under the guise of freedom of expression. They said it is unacceptable to insult Muslims by desecration of the Holy Quran.
We are condemning this atrocity because this is trampling upon our right as Muslims. attacking or burning the Holy Quran is as burning all the Muslims or even humanity in general, because you must respect what people respect. So we are condemning what happened in Sweden. By so doing, we are protesting so that such a thing should not happen elsewhere again.
The most significant part of the rally was the burning of the Swedish flag in condemnation of the provocative act. The demonstrators accused the Swedish government, the Europeans and the United States of complicity in the plot to insult and provoke Muslims around the world.
You don't fight ideologies with a barbaric act. The affair is the growth of Islam. If you look at the global trend, recent survey shows that the most popular name in the world is Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. I look at the trend of Islam and Muslims in Europe, definitely they are worried, and they have every reason to be worried. But it is the era of Islam.
Sweden has an infamous history of Islamophobic acts, and over the years, Muslims have been the target of violence simply because of their religion there. Enjim Abdullahi, Abuja.
In July 2014, Israeli forces waged an all-out war against the Gaza Strip that lasted for 50 days. During the course of the onslaught, Israeli forces killed some 2,200 people, including hundreds of innocent women and children. A further 11,000 were wounded. According to human rights organizations, the Israeli attacks on Palestinians during the 2014 war were systematic and deliberate, with disproportionate and excessive force used against civilians. Rights groups demand that Israeli war criminals be brought to justice.
9 years ago, Israel waged an all-out war on Gaza and committed war crimes. Israel used a tactic of bombing buildings with civilians inside and also attacked United Nations shelters. We have documented the killings and injuring of Palestinian civilians and the mass destruction of civilian infrastructure. We call on international legal bodies, including the International Criminal Court, to investigate the Israeli crimes and to hold the perpetrators accountable.
The 2014 war also saw the bombardment of thousands of homes and the displacement of around 500,000 people. The Israeli regime has consistently failed to make any attempt to hold individuals at any level responsible for the war crimes and crimes against humanity.
I was injured and my 60-year-old son was killed. 3 of my cousins were also killed. My family, along with 10 other families, were hiding in the basement when it was hit by an Israeli rocket.
During the 2014 war, the Israeli regime displayed callous indifference, launching attacks on family homes in the densely populated coastal strip. This is while the United States and other Western countries provided billions of dollars worth of military aid to the Israeli regime during and after the 2014 onslaught on Gaza.
The Israeli regime has shown zero accountability for the crimes perpetrated by its troops due to the protection it enjoys from the international community, especially from the United States. These actions encourage Israel to commit more crimes against the Palestinian people.
Despite Israel's grave violations of international law, Palestinians continue to suffer due to international apathy. Experts say that the Israeli regime has committed acts that amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity in the Gaza Strip since 2008. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Cluster bombs, which the administration of United States President Joe Biden recently classified as a war crime, will now be sent to Ukraine in Washington's latest escalation of the unrest. Cluster munitions are banned by over half the world because they release dozens of bomblets, which often remain unexploded for decades after a conflict has ended. They cause more casualties among civilians than among combatants, and the United States is sending bombs with the imprecise grenades used in the 1991 invasion of Iraq. From bombing irrigation dams in Korea to Agent Orange in Vietnam to using chemical weapons against Iranians, the United States and their Western partners continue to use tactics which the global majority often finds immoral, even during wartime.
These are omnicide weapons. They're the worst atrocities in history, each in a can. Do reduce any any sense of our moral authority in this war. Since we're not in this to protect civilians, we're not in this to protect Ukrainians, who we've maneuvered into being our foot soldiers and into dying for American interests while America doesn't sit comfortably at home.
With diplomacy off the table and Kiev's long-awaited counteroffensive a failure, Washington admitted that they are sending the bombs because they are running out of traditional ammunition.
Because of the dramatically high expenditure rates of artillery by Ukraine and by Russia, where we need to build a bridge from where we are today to when we have enough monthly production of unitary rounds. This is the moment to begin the construction of that bridge so that there isn't any period over this summer or heading into this fall when Ukraine is short on artillery.
Escalation is reaching such levels that some analysts in Russia are actually advocating the use of nuclear weapons against Western Europe as the only way to restore the fear of war among Western leaders and to finally end the 9-year conflict in Ukraine. The United States used similar logic against Japan in World War II.
Our government says that stresses that Russia has been using cluster bombs through the war. Russian President Putin is, if anything, unpopular in his country to the extent that he's the most popular politician there. But he gets grief for having gone into Ukraine too soft in an attempt not to kill the civilians that ultimately this civil war has been about. It's been a pogrom by Kiev and by ethnic Ukrainians in the west of the country against its east.
NATO members will meet next week in Lithuania, where many fear an even more significant expansion of the war will be announced. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Outside Israel's London embassy, thousands of pro-Palestine protesters vented their anger over Israel's raid in the Jenin refugee camp in occupied Palestine. Speakers condemned not only Israel's crimes, but the ongoing support Britain offers to Tel Aviv.
The horrific footage which is coming out of occupied Palestine by the hour and going viral on social media has sent shockwaves across the globe. These protesters have come out in large numbers here in London to vent their anger and to condemn the British authorities for their so-called complicity in the Israeli crimes against the occupied Palestinian people.
Protest organisers called Israel's assault on the refugee camp barbaric and urged the UK government to abandon plans to outlaw anti-Israel boycott campaigns, including the BDS movement.
It singles out Israel for special treatment, for protection from accountability, which is completely shameful. Why list one country and say, no matter what government is in place, that Israel should not be boycotted? The bill is dangerous on so many fronts. It should never have been brought forward, and it will be shameful if the UK passed this bill.
There is no such right as the right to self-defense for an occupying power. The Palestinian people who have been fighting occupation and fighting for liberation are the ones that have the right to defend themselves. And this is nothing but a justification and a deflection from Israeli perpetual violence against the Palestinians.
Israel and Gaza exchanged fire Wednesday as Israel's regime pulled out from their 2-day raid on the camp. At least 12 Palestinians have been killed, many just teenagers. The Palestinian Red Cross said around 3,000 have been forced to flee their homes to escape the violence. Despite the killings, the UK remains committed to pursuing the anti-BDS bill, making it harder for critics of Israel to support Palestine in Britain. Robert Carter, London.
After decades of activism and art, the collection that has been a lifetime in the making was unveiled. Sandra Wafter's Nakba, Palestinians' Ongoing Dispossession.
I thought it's time to go full circle and try and tap into another form, another method of educating people on the Palestinian flight, because 75 years on, it's still unrelenting, unremitting, as we've seen a couple of days ago in Jenin camp. The onslaughts just carry on relentlessly. And one tries in any way, every way, to shed light on this.
The launch of the collection has come amidst growing tensions in the region. This after a violent Israeli incursion into the Jenin refugee camp, resulting in the killings of yet more Palestinians.
The one key word here is ongoing. The Nakba never, ever ended. It just stops and starts, but there is always strife, there is always oppression, there is always colonization, there is always land theft. It just does not stop. So I just really look forward to the day when we can have a commemoration of the Nakba, because it would finally mean that it's ended, and this hasn't happened yet.
Wafter's work is visceral and emotive, but the artist wants to impart a message that goes beyond the gallery and into the very corridors of power.
You would think that the authors of our dispossession would hold for a minute and reconsider and consider standing on the right side to restitute this problem, this huge catastrophe that they have created. In fact, they are doubling down on shielding Israeli atrocities. It's very shameful, actually. 107 years now since the Balfour Declaration is just ridiculous. Britain has a chance to redress the extreme travesty of justice that it has birthed instead of going the other way and doubling down on shielding war crimes, in effect.
Artists like Sandra Wafter know the value their craft can make in keeping the memories of the Nakba front and center.
Art is powerful. It can evoke memories of a particular place or a moment in time. It can also be an exemplary tool of resistance. And for artists who are concerned and focused with justice for the Palestinians, well, their message is so important, more important than ever before.
The collection, Nakba, Palestinians' Ongoing Dispossession, is available now. Amina Taylor, London.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
NATO leaders say that they are prepared for Ukraine to ultimately join the military alliance. Now, a draft of the summit communique pledges to extend an invitation to Ukraine to join the alliance when allies agree and conditions are met. But the problem is that allies do not agree. Now, Ukrainian President Zelensky immediately hit out at the 31-member alliance for negotiating the text without Kiev at the table. Now, he complained that it seems, in his words, there is no readiness neither to invite Ukraine to NATO nor to make it a member of the alliance. Now, I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Stay with us for a discussion of Ukraine's NATO membership bid and the division among NATO members over the issue. Let's first see who is joining us in today's edition of The Spotlight. We'll have Christoph Porstel, author and politician from Berlin. And also from Walnut Tree in California, Rick Sterling, investigative journalist, is joining us. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now, let me begin with Christoph. My question for you is, as you just heard me in the intro, that NATO is saying that Ukraine's future lies in the military alliance, but there is no time frame, no guarantees either for Ukraine's accession. Now, doesn't this indicate divisions among NATO's 31 members over given a date for a straightforward invitation for Ukraine to join? You know, Kiev has been pushing for a swift entry with security guarantees since even before the war with Russia.
Yeah, of course there are divisions. Of course there's pressure within NATO. It sounds strange that President Erdogan of Turkey has suddenly declared that he's in favor of Kiev's membership within NATO, but still issues contradictive statements on the NATO membership of Sweden. So what we have here is a very interesting situation in where the old and new NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg says that Erdogan has told him that he is ready to accept Sweden as a NATO member. But we miss President Erdogan's own statement, and there are complicated issues about, you know, the formal conduct of this standpoint in the Turkish parliament. And there are forerunners saying that this is not sure that Turkey really supports Kiev, Ukraine, within NATO, because the parliament can say no. So these are very interesting situations right now. Certainly, NATO is strongly divided, and the US has a very strange policy. They insist that the NATO members push for Ukraine's membership and not the US, not Washington, whereas everybody knows that Washington is in favor of that, whereas in our media it is said that Washington is against it. So we have a very, very interesting situation in NATO. This is not what I call, in fact, a strong alliance. This is a strongly divided alliance.
Okay, now let me turn to Rick. Rick, you know, the issue of how to acknowledge Ukraine's membership ambitions while it's fighting Russia is indicative of divides within NATO, isn't it? Weeks of intense negotiations have been held, and the U.S. and Germany are still wary of implying that Kiev's membership is inevitable without conditions attached. Let's have your assessment.
Yeah, well, in the meeting here, NATO has dropped one formal requirement, which was the completing the membership application plan. But they've raised another vague and ambiguous condition, which is for conditions to be met. And I think significantly, the Secretary General of NATO said in the question and answer that unless Ukraine wins the war, there's no question of membership. And this goes along with the statements of Biden that it's not at all viable for Ukraine to join NATO while it's at war, because that would mean the U.S. and the other NATO countries would be at war. So I think they're giving they're trying to hold out the hope for Ukraine to be admitted to NATO in the future, but they realize that would be suicidal at the present time.
Okay. Now, Christoph, President Zelensky has reacted online. And he said, quoting him, it was unprecedented and absurd when a time frame is not set, neither for the invitation nor for Ukraine's membership. And he also attacked NATO's what he called vague conditions for inviting Kiev. You know, NATO agreed in 2008 that Ukraine will become a member, but provided no timeline or accession process. So what's the catch?
So we have, in fact, a double blackmail situation here. Very clearly, April last year, Zelensky was forced to stop any peace initiative already signed by his people with Russia. Mm-hmm. And now we have the situation where President Zelensky says, okay, yes or no, what do you want? If you, in fact, he says it indirectly, he doesn't say it directly. If you want us to continue to bleed for you, you better make us a member. Mm-hmm. And what is on the other side is that Zelensky simply might, you know, retire and ask another power to give him a home and an opportunity to run away from his job. Everybody knows that these things are on the table with the NATO, not openly, but secretly. So President Zelensky is playing a very, very dangerous double game. Behind the scenes, he has ventured to some of the traveling, diplomats that it is necessary that he needs a lot of money should he leave his job, because as he may have said, purportedly has said, that he has to pay his generals. Mm-hmm. And everybody knows that. Everybody knows that his position is crazy. Everybody knows that this war cannot be won by Kiev. Everybody knows that the fight is completely in vain. Everybody knows that if that continues and if there's more provocation like coming from President Macron right now offering a further reach of drones and things like that, that Russia, if these drones truly reach Russian territory, mm-hmm. that they are ready to, you know, forward so far that these drones can no longer reach Russian territory. That is the threat from Moscow. And sooner or later, that will come true, certainly, if these drones reach. So what do we have here? We have, in fact, a very dangerous stalemate with no exit, because Russia is the only winner without or with the stalemate. And that is something in a situation where, of course, we must understand that President Zelensky has to make his choices. And now he has given to NATO his idea that he thinks this is absurd. And we are very curious how long this Mr. Zelensky is ready and willing and able to keep up his absurd position.
Okay. Now, Rick, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says that NATO is also discussing, apart from membership, weapon supplies to Kiev. That's, you know, trying to push forward what is so-called counteroffensive against Russia. Russian spokesman also told reporters any move to speed up Ukraine's admission into NATO would be, quote, potentially very dangerous for European security. Now, do you see eye to eye? And if so, what type of danger is he alluding to?
Well, I'm not sure what type of is he suggesting that the Ukraine would be brought directly into NATO. I think perhaps he's alluding to that, and which would precipitate exactly the event that both Stoltenberg and Biden have spoken of, which is that if Ukraine was admitted to NATO, then NATO would be at war directly with Russia, and that would basically mean World War III. In the 17-page communique, which has been produced following today's NATO summit, there's a lot of platitudes, but there's also some statements that are significant, which is that NATO will never recognize any territory that has been admitted to the Russian Federation, and specifically Crimea. Of course, Crimea had a referendum in 2014, mm-hmm. and 97% of the population, with 83% turnout, said that they wanted to secede from Ukraine and join Russia. So, right. And this is the general situation that some 30% of the Ukrainian population identify as coming from Russian culture. Russian is their first language. So behind all the talk about democracy, there's an absolute absence of democracy. And that's also significant because Kiev has imprisoned one of the major opposition candidates. They've made illegal the Russian Orthodox Church. So there's a total absence of any pretense of democracy. So on those grounds as well, it's completely hypocritical for NATO to suggest that Ukraine should be part of their alliance.
Mm-hmm. Now, Christoph, in the middle of this membership bid at NATO, the West is offering arms to Ukraine, and it's in full swing. Larger and larger pledges are made. Even France, that's grappling with a plethora of issues and protests on the home turf, you know, says that it would send long-range Scalp cruise missiles to Ukraine, and the missiles are the same as Storm Shadow that UK already provided, you know. And the UK is also another European country, you know, facing strike action, you know, over a cost of living crisis and all that. So I want to ask you, what is it that makes these countries neglect their own issues at home and prioritize the issues of Ukraine over those of their own people?
You see that Germany is not a sovereign country is something which is sometimes openly issued by German higher politicians, but in fact it's all of Europe which has to follow Washington's wishes. And these governments obviously are more afraid of Washington than of their own voters and populations. And that is the situation that makes them go this belligerent way and aggressively furnishing a country which cannot, by definition, so to say, withstand Russia's troops with weapons which will only serve to kill more people, that's all. And I'm talking about Ukrainians and Russians alike. They are dying because of NATO weapons, all of them in vain, not for nothing. But completely in vain. It's a vain, useless, senseless, idiotic war only made up by corrupt forces in Washington. And that is a very, very tragic story that this continues so far. And that is behind all this NATO blah, blah, and all these offers and all these weapons is this in fact, grotesque dying of Ukrainian people for zero result for Ukraine.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Rick, why should such countries that are already grappling with their own issues, they are facing protests, strike action, on top of the strike action, protests over protests, but Ukraine comes first to them?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I wonder why more Americans and more Europeans are not asking it and out in the streets. I know that there are some protests. We've had some protests. No more weapons to Ukraine being the signature motto of one of the actions, but there should be much more. And the situation, I mean, behind the scenes of the NATO summit, there has to be a growing realization that the war is lost, as the other guest was saying, that the so-called counteroffensive was a complete failure. And the recent announcement that the U.S. is going to start sending cluster munitions,
exactly,
that's another dividing point. And even the foreign minister of Germany has come out against that, I understand.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The explanation from Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor of the U.S., was that they've run out of regular munitions. That they and they need the cluster munitions as they refer to it as a bridge or stopgap until they can produce more regular munitions. So that's mm-hmm. how desperate the situation is, and that's how badly the war is going from their standpoint.
Right. Christoph, this cluster munition is actually my next question, and Rick mentioned it. You know, all NATO allies are stressing that they have this primary objective that they're pushing is to make sure that Ukraine has what's necessary to continue to fight with Russia. And the U.S. has gone even as far as trying to provide Ukraine with controversial cluster bombs. You know what cluster bombs mean. And the U.S. has a long record of using cluster bombs. You know, 120-plus countries oppose this, and so do some Western allies of Washington. Your take on that?
First of all, that shows that our ammunition reserves have been, you know, plundered, in fact, and they are empty. And it is said by our military expert that 6 to 12 hours Germany army would be able to withstand if there's an attack. And after that, we run out of ammunition. Mm-hmm. So this is true. But of course, this is no excuse, viable and useful in any way, that you provide another country in a war situation with cluster bombs. Cluster bombs are forbidden, and it is very clear that the U.S. is breaking again a law, yeah, and a rule, and something which has been agreed, rightly say, under 20 countries. Kiev signed, yeah. In former times, of course. So this is a perverted situation that shows in a very bright light the extent of criminal policies to which Washington is ready to go in order to make sure that the dying of Ukrainians continues. Mm-hmm. And that's so far a terrible, in fact, a terrible fact that we face with this NATO summit, that all of NATO is unable to speak out in favor of rules of law. We call ourselves the rules-based West, And we spit on any rule, we spit on any law, we spit on any contract if we have to and continue our dirty policies. So in fact, this is a shame summit of NATO there in Vilnius. And that they need so much security for these politicians, that seems natural.
Exactly. Now, Rick, all NATO member states agree that Ukraine cannot join the alliance while the war is going on. That's what also President Biden said. Now, it's because they say that this would trigger NATO's Article 5 mutual defense clause and bring all members into conflict. You know, but the thing is this really why they're saying this? Because, you know, they are involved in the war, given all the military and logistical support for Kyiv. Mm-hmm.
They are involved in the war, but it's the Ukrainians who are doing the dying. So from the United States perspective, and of course the NATO is completely dominated by the United States, this is okay. They can even see, you can even see that there's an economic advantage to the United States, because all of a big portion at least of the military hardware that's going to Ukraine is manufactured in the United States. So the military industrial complex, their stocks have been rising. They're doing fine. They're getting very hefty contracts to produce more and more munitions and weapons. And many of the European states that have been providing weapons to Ukraine, they're coming to the United States to supply them. There's one area where the United States is an industrial leader. One of the few areas that are left is in the military hardware side of things. So that's the sad thing, and I completely agree with the other guest here that this is tragic and this is totally unnecessary. Mm-hmm. And Ukrainians are dying, and it's people like Lindsey Graham, the senator from the Republican Party in Washington, longtime senator, who's even said explicitly, this is kind of an ideal situation. Ukrainians are helping us destabilize and weaken Russia. So that's the tragic and sad thing about this. The Ukrainians are tools in this proxy war, which is unnecessary and should be ended immediately.
Okay, and Christoph, the G7, advanced Western economies are also separately preparing to announce a multilateral security arrangement for Ukraine on Wednesday, and this is following the NATO summit. And that would mean bilateral pledges, which are set to include military and financial support packages for Kyiv to help it fight Russia, for, quote, as long as it takes. How much longer would it go on, in your opinion?
First of all, it goes as long as the peoples in the West support it. So if they storm the White House, and if they depose the illegal U.S. government, that's finished. And there's another point. If we do that in Germany, that would be even enough to finish it, because without making sure that Germany is a victim of this war in Ukraine, Washington would not be ready to continue. So this is a very interesting question. I'm right now in an election campaign in Germany, and we see the situation very, very clearly. Unless, you know, peace promotion is backed by enough people, war will win, and that is a rule worldwide.
Okay, and I got one last question for both of you. You have each 1 minute. Rick, what's the prospect of security in Europe, you know, given the goings-on in that part of the world, and how would that impact security worldwide?
Well, the prospects are not good at the current moment, because the United States and their so-called partners in NATO keep going up the escalation ladder. They said they wouldn't send long-range missiles, then they overturned that. Then they indicated they wouldn't do depleted munitions, then they did that. They said they wouldn't do, cluster bombs and so on and so forth. The attack on the Nord Stream pipeline, which was clearly carried out by the U.S. and or allies, and blowing up of the dam, the Kukovo Dam, the threats against the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant. Where's the escalation going to stop? So I totally agree that we need an outpouring of opposition to the war. It's It's hurting people worldwide and endangering, you know, the entire world.
Okay. Chris, if you have 1 minute.
Yeah. We have a very, very bad perspective. In fact, our governments fight against their own people. They keep their opposition divided, espionaged upon. They keep them under pressure, under illegal pressure. So the whole judicial apparatus is being misused to oppress the opposition in Western countries, in Germany, of course, as well. Our little party, what happens to us is crazy. So we have a situation where the European people have no means left to liberate themselves. All these rulers are externally and internally going forward illegally. And that is a very, very bad situation. And I don't see any close positive viewpoint on this, and I'm very much fearing escalation.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Christoph Forstel in Berlin, Germany, Rick Sterling in Walnut Creek, California. And thank you. See you next time.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
Human rights defenders have condemned the Zionist regime's planned West Bank settlement expansion. According to reports, the Netanyahu regime has informed the U.S. of plans to build thousands of new Jewish-only settler homes. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truth Out noted, human rights defenders have recently blasted Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's far-right apartheid government after it reportedly informed the Biden administration of plans to build thousands of new Jewish-only settler homes in the illegally occupied West Bank of Palestine. Three Israeli regime and U.S. officials told Axios that Israel will announce later this month its intention to build at least 4,000 homes in existing West Bank settler colonies. Recently, the Zionist and international media reported that Netanyahu's government would postpone plans for what's known as E1 project due to U.S. pressure. For two decades, the Zionist regime and international human rights experts have called the settlements, which are illegal under Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention and the International Criminal Court's Rome Statute, part of the Zionist regime's apartheid. The seizure of Palestinian land in the occupied territories is also a war crime under the Rome Statute. The Zionist regime's finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, who opined in 2021 that all, not just most, Arabs should have been ethnically cleansed from Palestine at Israel's birth, said during a recent press conference that we will have big news for the settlements in the West Bank imminently. This is while the Biden administration has largely turned a blind eye to the Zionist settlement construction and expansion, but says it is strongly opposed to E1 because it would reduce the Palestinian population in East Al-Quds and further diminish faint hopes of any so-called two-state solution. Adala, an Israel-based advocacy group for Arab minority rights, tweeted, "Since the new Israeli government was inaugurated in December 2022, it has taken a series of alarming steps to accelerate its annexation of the West Bank, aiming to fulfill its commitments to increase Jewish settlements and ultimately extend Israeli sovereignty across the West Bank." Adala asserted that the Zionist regime's new annexation moves entrench Jewish supremacy and apartheid in the West Bank by steps including the institutional transfer of authority from military to civilian government offices in order to dismantle the authority of the military administration, assert Israeli state sovereignty, and promote the settlements, the further regularization and expansion of illegal settlements, and the direct application of Israeli domestic law to the occupied West Bank. These are part of an explicit plan by Israel to annex Suaves of the West Bank and institute full Israeli sovereignty over them, Adala asserted, adding, they violate international law, including the Rome Statute, constituting crimes against humanity, war crimes, and a crime of aggression. The Zionist regime is blatantly violating international law with its annexation of the West Bank. The American government can and should materially pressure the Zionist regime to stop impeding on Palestinian human rights. The U.S. gives the Zionist regime around $3.8 billion in mostly unconditional military aid each year. According to the Middle East Eye, Axios reported recently that the Zionist regime informed the U.S. it plans to build 4,000 housing units in several existing West Bank settlements. The report comes after Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government shelved plans to expand a settlement east of Al-Quds, which, if constructed, would divide the occupied West Bank into two. The plans for E1 settlement project, which would see 3,412 housing units built for Israeli settlers on occupied Palestinian lands, would connect the Kfar Adumim and Male Adumim settlements with occupied East Al-Quds. The plan would effectively split the West Bank in half, isolating East Al-Quds from Palestinian communities in the West Bank and forcing Palestinians to make even lengthier detours to travel from one place to another, while allowing for settlements housing Israelis to expand. The U.S. and the European Union have long objected to the settlement plan, warning successive Israeli administrations not to move forward with the project. Under the Biden administration, Washington has issued statements in opposition to new Israeli regime settlement plans. In May, a U.S. State Department spokesperson rebuked the Zionist regime's government moves to legitimize the outpost of Homesh in occupied West Bank, originally established on private Palestinian land. The spokesperson claimed in a statement, "This order is inconsistent with both former Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's written commitment to the Bush administration in 2004 and the current Israeli government's commitment to the Biden administration," adding, "Advancing Israeli settlements in the West Bank is an obstacle to the achievement of a two-state solution." The Zionist regime has repeatedly ignored U.S. opposition when it comes to settlement expansion, including recently in February when the Zionist regime government announced it would be expanding Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. However, at the same time, Washington has moved to protect the Zionist regime's settlement policy, saying in that same month that it would oppose a resolution that would condemn Israeli settlements at the UN Security Council.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.